Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The hunt in the Java Sea turns up another four bodies today. And in Nigeria, attack by the Boko Haram. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. AirAsia officials say four more bodies were recovered from the Java Sea today as Indonesian rescue and recovery teams continue searching for the wreckage of a passenger jet that disappeared 1 week ago. Bad weather and murky water have hampered efforts to locate most of the 162 people believed to have died aboard Flight 8501. Ron Corbin reports from Bangkok. The loss has hit the Christian community in the area very hard.
The tragedy weighed heavily on Surabaya's Christian community. One church lost 40 parishioners when the AirAsia flight crashed in the Java Sea. Pastor Bernardo Corre Di Maggio from the International Christian Assembly in Surabaya said the community had been brought together by the tragedy.
It has been such a distraught moment. We even held an impromptu prayer night. We opened up the church for prayer.
The search for bodies and debris moved into a new phase Sunday with deployment of locators to pinpoint signals from the jet's black box data recorders. Ron Corbin, VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
Suspected Boko Haram militants have seized a military base in the Nigerian town of Baga. Local residents said the militants overwhelmed troops after an hours-long battle at the facility near Lake Chad. The base is used by the multinational joint task force made up of soldiers from Nigeria, Chad, and Niger. A suicide car bomber in Somalia's capital, Mogadishu, has killed at least four people. A security spokesman told VOA the forces had surrounded the car in Waberi district near Mogadishu's international airport when an Al-Shabaab militant detonated explosives inside his car. The victims were civilians. This is VOA News. Israel is weighing additional steps to punish Palestinians for efforts to join the International Criminal Court and thereby file war crimes charges against Israel, even as it freezes $125 million in tax revenues collected for them. Speaking to his cabinet today, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called the Palestinians' move to join the ICC confrontational and said he will not allow Israeli soldiers and commanders to be dragged to The Hague for prosecution. On Saturday, Israel responded by freezing $100 million in tax revenues collected from Palestinians for Palestinians. Israel's Minister of Strategic Affairs, Yuval Steinitz, says the financial freeze is similar to other global financial initiatives.
Both sides should respect our previous commitments. And once the Palestinians are violating all the basic commitments of the Oslo Accords, they are taking unilateral steps, Israel will react.
On Friday, Palestinian officials submitted their documents to the UN to join the ICC just days after the UN Security Council rejected a draft resolution setting a three-year deadline for the establishment of a Palestinian state. Pakistan says its airstrikes have killed 31 militants and a suspected U.S. drone strike has killed another seven insurgents in the tribal regions along the Afghan border. Islamabad said its Air Force destroyed four terrorist hideouts and a suicide bomber training center in the Khyber tribal district. Pakistan has stepped up its counter-militancy army operations in the tribal areas since a militant raid against an army-run school in Peshawar on December 16th killed 150 people, almost all of them children. Local intelligence officials say the drone fired two missiles that struck a militant compound in the mountainous Dalil Khayal area near the Afghan border. Massive fires are still burning in South Australia and may have turned deadly. Two people are missing and dozens of homes destroyed. South Australia's premier asked people in 19 states this weekend to evacuate, which Jo Morse did, but she had a request of fire and rescue workers.
When they turned up here, I could see the house was well alight, and I just said to them, let it go, save my animals, and we did.
Fire officials say the worst affected areas are South Australia and Victoria states, with dozens of homes destroyed and damaged. The dry conditions, high winds, and temperatures in the upper 40 Celsius are creating extremely adverse conditions, allowing fires to rage out of control in all directions. And here in Washington, President Barack Obama on his way back after 2 weeks in his home state of Hawaii. The political landscape in Washington changed while Mr. Obama was out of town. Republicans will be in full control of both houses of Congress, and many are eager to start chipping away at his initiatives starting this week. I'm Marty Johnson, reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
It's not such a difficult campaign. If some people give you the sum and you have to go back to them after 3 years because of the debt, then, you know, there's a natural feeling.
The Zambian acting president predicts electoral victory for the ruling party in the upcoming by-election.
The number of people dying from HIV and AIDS-related illness is dramatically or drastically reduced to less than 50,000.
The Zimbabwean government makes strides in curbing the prevalence of HIV infection rates among its citizens.
Vous savez qu'en ce moment, nous les chrétiens, nous les populations centrafricaines, on a des difficultés.
This man, Yakbanga Fiane, says, we the Christians, the Central African people, are in difficulty because the Pearl are making war on the Christians.
And religion is reportedly fueling conflict among farmers in the Central African Republic. We'll have details, those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Zambian acting president has expressed confidence that voters will elect Edgar Lungu, the flag bearer for the ruling Patriotic Front or PF, as the next president in the upcoming by-election. President Guy Scott said allegations that the PF has implemented schemes, including plans to use state security officials to rig the January 20 vote, are completely false. Mr. Scott told me earlier that the ruling party has intensified campaign efforts in the run-up to the election.
The campaign is going according to plan. In fact, it's going excellently. You know, it's not such a difficult campaign. If some people give you a sum and you have to go back to them after 3 years because of the debt, then, you know, there's a natural feeling that that they owe you the next 2 years, the remaining period. So there's quite a strong sympathy vote there. For the death of Michael Sata and for our attempt to carry out our programs for 5 years.
So, Mr. President, what current role are you playing in your presidential candidate's campaign?
I am the middleman. I'm the acting president between the last day of the first one and the first day of the third one.
Mr. President, we heard reports that former President Rupia Banda has decided to endorse your presidential candidate. What does this mean for your party?
It's probably good news. I doubt it means bad news. But we haven't had actually any definite statement to that effect. But it looks like we're getting one. But that's not all cut and dried. It hasn't all been served up. But that will just strengthen our hand.
How has been the response of Zambians to your campaign so far?
Very positive. Very, very positive. That's part of the reason we haven't been able to talk for the last few hours. There's so much shouting and ululating and cheering and singing that I've been unable to talk to you.
I heard you went to the club with your wife. Is it part of the campaign?
Well, it depends. I mean, I've danced with Mrs. Obama, for example. I don't know whether that was part of the Obama's campaign or whether it was part of my campaign or whether it was just normal human beings operate at a festive occasion.
Some people are saying this is a strange bedfellow for Mr. Banda to endorse Mr. Lungu, looking at the fact that you defeated him in the last election.
Yes, but politics is full of strange bedfellows. Politics is about things that work, and sometimes only you have to put up with a fair amount of strangeness for things to work.
So what is your campaign promise now that you have less than 3 weeks?
The campaign promises we'll stick to where we were for 3 years in government, looking after the poor, emphasizing the poor, emphasizing the disadvantaged, the vulnerable, emphasizing infrastructure recovery, because our roads have all been broken to a bit, bringing education up to scratch for our increased population, and doing various things like that, and getting rid of corruption. So we're going to stick to the policies that we laid down and was elected in the first place.
Do you have confidence in the ability of the Electoral Commission to administer a credible vote, since there are accusations by some opposition members that it will be rigged?
The accusations are always there, always there. And the accusations are always there, and the accusations have never been proven, never been demonstrated, despite very lengthy and exhaustive court process, investigative processes. Nothing even quite as bad as Florida, I don't think, has ever been proved in Zambia.
The issue is there seemed to be coordination for a possible presidential debate. Do you foresee this happening?
We've got 11 or 12 candidates, some very marginal, who've signed on for the presidential contest. And if we try to put them all on, there'll just be a cacophonous mess. And if we try to select, or if the radio station tries to select two or three or four of them, it'll be open to criticism. So in our culture, political culture is not just working out very well.
So how are you combining your job as the acting president and campaigning for your candidate? How is the running of the administration so far, juggling these two important positions?
Normally my day consists of 8 hours of working as vice president, 8 hours of relaxation, and 8 hours of sleep. Now it's 8 hours of doing my job as president, 8 hours of campaigning, and another 8 hours of relaxing, sometimes known jokingly as trying to get to sleep.
Guy Scott is the Zambian acting president. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. For more on the latest political developments, Richard Mulonga is a Zambian freelance journalist. He joins us live via telephone link up from the capital, Lusaka. Good evening, Richard.
Good evening, Peter. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. And how are you as well?
I'm fine here.
Wonderful. Now, former President Rupia Banda has officially endorsed Edgar Lungu. What were his reasons for the endorsement?
He has given quite a number of reasons, because he says Edgar Lungu is the only leader who can bring development to Zambia. And then he failed also to strike an alliance with the UPND, who are also using his son, you know, to campaign for him and many other reasons. So he has only seen hope in the PF that they have agreed that they could work together. But there's a detailed plan on how they're going to work together and so on and so forth.
Will his endorsement have any impact at all on who wins the January 20 presidential by-election?
Yes. The Rupia Banda's endorsement of Edgar Lungu has got a lot of influence and is expected to actually influence the voting pattern, especially in the eastern part of Zambia, where President Banda comes from. This is actually the stronghold for the MMD. And actually, you realize that President Banda not long ago had made admissions to come back to active politics. And he has supporters across the country who will cast a vote, not for him, but for the candidate that he has endorsed.
Now, what is the MMD saying about his endorsement? Because he was then going to run on the ticket of the MMD before the court's decision.
Yes, the MMD has been experiencing turbulent waters of late. You know, there's an MMD president who's the candidate for that party, and we have Rupia Banda here, who has endorsed Edgar Lungu. We have got other members of parliament who have endorsed the other opposition party, the UPND. So the MMD have not issued an official statement regarding the endorsement, but they're on different camps with Rupia Banda since the last few weeks.
Now, recently, former President Banda said that he wanted to have partnered with Hakainde Hichilema of UPND. What led to the fallout between the two men before he decided to throw his weight behind Edgar Lungu of the PF?
President Banda explained that the deal fell through because Hakainde Hichilema wanted President Rupia Banda to be the vice president of the country. But Rupia Banda refused because he is more senior than Hakainde Hichilema, realizing that Rupia Banda, you know, was the president before, so he could not stoop so low to become vice president to someone who has not been president before. This is the explanation that he also gave during the meeting here today to endorse Edgar Lungu.
Now, the Electoral Commission of Zambia is displeased with the deputy president of the UPND after he said that they are printing some ballot papers to rig the election. What is the situation?
The Electoral Commission of Zambia has actually summoned the vice president for the UPND, Dr. Kanisha Banda, so that he could substantiate his claims. They are alleging that his claims are very grievous and have the potential to, you know, dent the image of the commission and actually, you know, throw the next elections into doubt. So we haven't been given a date when Dr. Kanisha Banda will appear before the ECZ, but we will keep watching and just follow up the matter and see what decisions are going to make.
Thank you very much. Richard Mulunga is a Zambian freelance journalist. He just joined us from the capital, Lusaka. Dr. Owen Mugurungi is the Zimbabwean director of the AIDS and Tuberculosis Unit in the Health and Childcare Ministry. He says they expect to meet the Health Millennium Development Goals set by the United Nations. He told VOA Studio 7's reporter Blessing Zulu that Zimbabwe has managed to reduce HIV prevalence rates by nearly 30%.
Today, the number of people dying from HIV and AIDS-related illness is dramatically or drastically reduced to less than 50,000. And this is an indication that treatment is now working. You also can look at the prevalence. The prevalence had come down to 13.9% in 2009, and it has maintained around that figure of 14. Now it's about 15.
Would you say Zimbabwe is meeting the targets it is set to achieve in fighting the disease?
We're gaining in terms of prevalence, not because there are more people infected, but simply because the number of people that we've put on treatment is good, and a lot of people are now surviving. People are no longer dying. However, when you look at the rate of new infection, this is continuing to decline. We estimate that incidence or new infection has declined from around 1% to 0.85%. The number of new infections that we're recording in adults has come down from around 150,000 again 10 years ago, 150,000 per year 10 years ago in 2002, to less than 50,000 currently. The number of new infections in children through mother-to-child transmission is also dramatically reduced from around 30% in 2002 to less than 8% in 2013.
It seems with the declining economy, a lot of companies are closing. People are being asked to pay for services at the health facilities. And also people have difficulty in getting to the health facilities. So it's become very difficult for a lot of people to access health services. People need to get treatment. And people who have been in jobs have also been the ones supporting a lot of other people. So it means along the line, one person loses a job, a lot of people suffer because of that.
Dr. Owen Mugurungi is the Zimbabwean director of the AIDS and Tuberculosis Unit in the Health and Child Care Ministry. He spoke with reporter Blessing Zulu of VOA Studio 7 from the capital, Harare. Optimal Drive International, a Ghanaian-based NGO, unearths academically brilliant sports talents and offers them opportunities to higher education at universities in Canada and the United States. Ian Oseowusu is the executive director of the Optimal Drive International. He joins us live via telephone link up from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. Good evening, Ian.
Good evening.
Now, Ian, tell me, what is the significance or relevance, if you may, of your organization's drive to help underprivileged children in Ghana?
Thank you very much, and greetings to your listeners. Optimal Drive International is a non-profit organization, as you might know, and the organization uses sport as one of its mediums to enhance the development of the Ghanaian youth, both locally and internationally. And one of such developmental initiatives is what we call the G-Step. The G-Step, which is the Ghana Sports Technocrat Excellence Program, and it was set up to use sport as a means for quality education, build grassroots coaching capacity, enable talented soccer players to also have access to higher level soccer and education, because it's also a need for our society. We also try to activate humanitarian services within communities in Ghana and also build sustainable communities from within our own. So the relevance to the youth in our community is that we are able to offer them a platform where they are able to exhibit their talents and also have some of the needs that we know are also integral to our sports and education also addressed.
Now, Ian, you partner some universities in the West. What entails in this partnership?
We do partner some universities in the West, just like you said. What is entailed in this partnership is that we are able to have them as development partners who are able to extend scholarships to these brilliant and then talented players in our community, and so that they are also able to extend their education to the Western world and be able to also come back to help the system.
What, if I may ask you, are the prospect of success of your organization in helping these underprivileged children in Ghana?
Well, what we would say is that we find that we have a need, and we have a need for sports, and we have a need for education. They are all needs, and we also try that we can have these development partners to be able to help us understand how our needs are and also be able to help, answer questions to these needs. And that is what they do for us. For instance, we have these coaches come down, and what they do is that they offer soccer clinics, and that is on the humanitarian level. They offer soccer clinics to age groups from the age of 6 upwards. And then what we do again is that they also give out slightly used soccer equipment to these students and these pupils who are able to engage in the G-Step. Another aspect is what Umbro does for us, who is also another partner to us. Umbro also gives out some uniforms to all these students and kids who are able to engage in these projects. And for us, what it does help is that we are also able to feel the essence of sports, which is a passion that we have, but also are able to realize that their education are an integral part of their passion for sports.
Is there any emphasis particularly on the nutritional health needs of these children?
Yes. The G-Step really takes a long-term player development, route. And what it does is that it allows kids from all ages, like that we said, from the tender age of 6, to be able to run through the long-term development projects and be able to understand that they are physical literacy, their eating, their nutrition, and everything is part of their passion for sports. And that is the educational aspect that we bring into the program. And what it does is that it advises the kids on what to eat, on how to dress, how to also be literally educated physically for the sport that they want to engage in.
How are these underprivileged children responding to your organization's need or drive to help them?
It was the inaugural project was held in 2013, and it was held in communities in Accra and Kumasi. And we partnered with other development agents who were able to even donate Tom shoes to these kids. And these are very needy kids. I remember when Steve Hart from the University of Windsor was around, he was so much touched by the number of people, the number of kids that were here, and how much they responded to the soccer clinics. And at the end of the day, the little that were able to, and the program was able to give back to them, as in the slightly used equipment, as well as the Tom shoes that were also giving out. At the end of the day, we realized that the kids were so much happy be part of this project, and we're really looking forward. The other part of it was the ones that were picked, and what the talented students that were picked, what we offer them is an education in the outside world, which would also enhance them. And that is not just up to the university level, but to as much as they can also extend the education, the project offers them that opportunity.
Now, lastly, if I may ask you, are any private individuals or companies in Ghana interested in this partnership to help these children, briefly?
Well, yes, we have consulted a couple of corporate entities to be able to even own the project. that Optimal Drive International would run the project on a yearly basis. As we currently speak, we have spoken to a couple of corporates, and they have also expressed some interest. We are going to take that further on. We have spoken to the technical director for the Ghana Football Association, and we've also spoken to the sports director for the University of Ghana, which is Legon. And we have partners such as the Sports Council as well. And these are people who have expressed their interest in running this project for it to become a very long-term project.
Thank you very much. Ian Oseowusu is the executive director of the Optimal Drive International. He joined us live from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. The International Crisis Group said last month that a hidden conflict is underway in the rural parts of the Central African Republic. The conflict is between cattle herders, who are mostly Muslims, from the Pearl ethnic group, and farmers, who are mostly Christians. Livestock experts are looking for ways to restore friendly relations between the communities and to prevent more of the violence that has torn the country apart for the past 2 years. For VOA, Nick Long reports from Bambari, a town on the cattle rail.
A mission of livestock experts from a National Cattle Herders Federation, international aid groups and UN and government agencies recently visited rural areas of the Central African Republic. The group found that nomadic and semi-nomadic cattle herders are generally not welcome in agricultural areas. Clashes develop when the herders come under attack and then retaliate. Almost inevitably, the fighting takes on religious or ethnic overtones. Displaced people living at a camp in Bambari told VOA they had fled from the Pearl. This man, Yakbanga Vianney, says, "We, the Christians, the Central African people, are in difficulty because the Pearl are making war on the Christians. That's why we have taken refuge at this site. Most CAR residents are Christians, while the Pearl, a small minority in the nation of 5 million people, are usually Muslims. Recently, aid workers say about 1,000 Christians have been relocating to Bambari every week to escape dangerous conditions in their home villages. The attacks on villages often seem to be reprisals for attacks on the Pearl, usually carried out by anti-Balaka militia groups. This man, Ngeri Bisikoa, tells VOA his village was attacked and many houses burned by the Pearl, who thought the area was occupied by anti-Balaka members. The violence around Bambari has mainly been happening along two roads leading south. They seem to be front lines between anti-Balaka coming from the west and the Pearl, who have been driven out of many of their grazing grounds. A health worker at Bambari Hospital, who gave his name as Alex, explained.
Okay, this area is occupied by Bororo's people, who are cattlemen, the Pearl. But there is invasion of Balaka people there. That's why all the time there are movement, there is fighting on this way.
Much of Bambari is controlled by a Pearl warlord, Ali Darassa, who has set up his own movement called the Union for Peace in the CAR, or UPC, its acronym in French. The UPC spokesman, Captain Ahmad Nejad, blamed the anti-Balaka for most of the burned villages, but he acknowledged that Muslims have committed reprisals.
La quasi-totalité de ces villages qui sont incendiés, c'est incendié par des anti-Balaka.
Even if Muslims do sometimes burn a village, Captain Nejad said, there will have been a reason, and so long as the anti-Balaka don't touch anyone, there won't be any reprisals. A seasonal migration of cattle from north to south is now underway, and the joint mission of livestock experts warned this could lead to further violence. The experts recommend placing peacekeepers near the Chadian border to help minimize violent incidents. They also say that providing vaccination services for cattle might persuade herders to follow recommended trails instead of allowing their livestock to roam over cultivated land, a common practice that is one of the root causes of bad relations between herders and farmers. Nick Long for VOA News, Bambari.
Hello, Africa. This is James Butte, host of Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Join me Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC for the latest in African news, features, and sports. We are also available on the internet at www.voaafrica.com. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show on the Voice of America. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Segun Ademi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Lagos, Nigeria, and join Segun Ademi. Good evening, Segun.
Happy New Year to you, Peter, and to all our listeners across Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, January 4th, the very first edition of the show for 2015. It's just about 2 weeks to the kickoff of the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations in Equatorial Guinea, and we have lots of news about the tournament. With the championship fast approaching, the host nation has fired coach Andoni Goicoechea, plunging his preparations into chaos. Goicoechea departed on Thursday after the election of a new president for the Equatorial Guinea Football Federation, known as FEGUFOOT. New federation president André Mbomio confirmed the sacking of the former Spanish international, who had been in charge for the last 2 years, but gave no reasons. Failure in the recent regional competition for the Equatorial Guinea side, plus defeat in 2 warm-up games in Portugal last week, likely triggered the sack of the coach. Equatorial Guinea, which last month stepped in as emergency host of the Nations Cup in place of Morocco, has been preparing for the tournament in Portugal. The host will play Congo in the opening game of the 16-nation tournament in Bata on January 17th. Also in Equatorial Guinea's group are Burkina Faso and Gabon. Talking about preparations, the Black Stars of Ghana on Saturday officially kick-started their preparations for the Nations Cup. The team trained in Ghana's capital, Accra. Captain Asamoah Gyan and 24 other players who had been involved in informal training sessions during their holidays were all available. The training was the final send-off for the Black Stars, who traveled to Spain to continue with their preparations. Newly appointed fitness trainer Jamie Lawrence got the day's workout started when he led the players through fitness exercises. Coach Avram Grant and assistant Maxwell Konadu took charge of the session. Ghana is in the top Group C at the 38th edition of the two-yearly Nations Cup, alongside Senegal, South Africa, and Algeria. Also, the Algerian national football team on Friday began preparations for the tournament. As part of the preparations, Algeria will play a friendly match against Tunisia in Tunis on January 11th, before flying to Equatorial Guinea 4 days later. Algeria is in the so-called group of death with Ghana, South Africa, and Senegal. And from Mali comes the report that giant striker Cheikh Diabaté requires a knee operation and will be out for 4 months, meaning he will miss the Africa Cup of Nations. The 26-year-old Diabaté, who is playing professionally in France, agreed to undergo surgery after a consultation with a specialist in Marseille last month. Diabaté, who stands at an imposing 1.94 meters, had been called up for Mali for the Cup of Nations. However, he had been complaining of recurring problems with his knee for several months. Meanwhile, Mali has called up forward Mohamed Traoré to replace Diabaté. Traoré plays for the top Sudanese club, Almeric. Mali is in Group D at the Nations Cup alongside Ivory Coast, Cameroon, and Guinea.
Hi, this is VOA's Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. You're listening to my friend Segun Dot on the spot at Adeyemi and Nightline Africa Sports.
Thank you, Sonny, and Happy New Year to you. Well, as the final countdown to the opening of the three-week tournament continues, several teams have started naming their final squads. According to African Soccer's governing body, CAF, all the 16 finalists must submit their final 23-member squads by midnight on Wednesday, January 7th. Any nation that fails to meet the CAF deadline will be fined, in addition to having its player allocation reduced to 22. Among the teams that have already beaten the deadline is South Africa. In naming his team, coach Ephraim Seet Mashaba surprisingly left out Ajax Amsterdam's midfielder, Tulani Serero. Mashaba said he omitted Serero from the 23-member squad because, quote, other players were better than him, unquote. Ivory Coast has also named its final squad. Coach Abdou Renard named Nations Cup veterans and familiar faces, such as Captain Yaya Toure and elder brother Kolo, Jevin Mo, Salomon Kalou, Bubakar Barry, and Chet Tiote in his final squad. The Elephants of Ivory Coast will open an 11-day training on Monday in Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates, in preparation for the championship. Ivory Coast is in Group D with Mali, Cameroon, and Guinea. Well, as I reported last week, one team that will be watching the 2015 Nations Cup finals on television is Nigeria, which is the defending champion. The Super Eagles of Nigeria failed to qualify for the Equatorial Guinea tournament, to the disappointment of many football fans. Among them is former Super Eagles captain, Nwankwo Kanu. Kanu told the football website Goal.com that 2014 was a disappointing year for Nigerian football because of the Eagles' failure to qualify for the Nations Cup. If we are not featuring among the best countries in Africa that will participate in the 2015 AFCON, that is the Nations Cup, it simply means that something went wrong with our football in 2014, he said. Echoing Kanu is a Nigerian parliamentarian and football enthusiast, Ogbonna Nwoke. Nwoke says Nigeria will be sorely missed at the 2015 Nations Cup finals.
But I think the world will miss Nigeria's absence. I think the Africans themselves will miss Nigeria's absence. We'll bring a great some difference to the game. The way we play, the way we celebrate, even the way we sing when the game is on. And I think the world will miss that definitely. I think the African world will be wondering how come a former champion, just champion of the game in South Africa, suddenly fizzles out when it matters most. That's the game. It's always, like we say in sports, let the best win.
He also speaks on what needs to be done to raise the standard of football in Nigeria.
We need to lay appropriate foundations. It's just not enough for us to depend on our boys who have been tutored abroad by foreign coaches. I believe the time has come to fully establish Nigerian league. The time has come to for coaches here to look further inwards. There are talents everywhere. Those who are playing abroad began their play at home. They were not made abroad. And so if we work hard, if we remove politics from football, if we bring in proper football administrators, not just opportunists that are beginning to gravitate in the direction of the football house, then we can put Nigeria's football back on track.
That was Nigerian parliamentarian Ogbonna Nwoke commenting on the absence of the Super Eagles of Nigeria from the 2015 Nations Cup finals in Equatorial Guinea. He spoke with reporter Tony Tamuno in Port Harcourt. Finally, the stage is set for the 2014 Glocaf Awards, the annual extravaganza that celebrates the best in African football. The 2014 edition will be held in Nigeria's commercial city of Lagos on Thursday, January 8th. The awards gala will see players and officials who have distinguished themselves during the year 2014, receiving honors for their achievements. Winners of the prestigious African Player of the Year, as well as of 15 other categories, will be unveiled during the gala night. Some of the other categories are African Player of the Year, based in Africa, National Team of the Year, Club of the Year, Referee of the Year, and Coach of the Year. Africa's finest 11 will also be revealed on the night that will be attended by the creme de la creme of the continent's football icons. Ivorian midfielder Yaya Toure was named the African Player of the Year for the third time at the last edition held on January 9, 2014, also here in Lagos. Toure has also been named in the three-man shortlist for the 2014 award, meaning he has a chance to clinch a record fourth consecutive African Footballer of the Year title. This will mark the third time that Lagos will be hosting the prestigious event after 2008 and 2013. Previous host cities include the Nigerian capital, Abuja, in 2005, Ghana's capital, Accra, in 2006, 2009, 2011, and 2012, Lomé, the capital of Togo, in 2007, and the Egyptian capital, Cairo, in 2010. Nigerian telecommunications company Globacom has sponsored the annual awards gala since 2005. That ends it for this first edition of Nightline Africa Sports for 2015. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Peter Klote in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African Sports Nightline, Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Safari, ujana ni manji ya moto walilena gaza mani pili tumetoka mbali o maratizo changamoto tuvisa visa furani hey, o tatu kidonda chako kwangu maradhi matuso none kapo kwangu simanzi ay tatu kidonda chako kwangu maradhi o yani tuso none kapo kwangu simanzi kwa mahaba ulonipa imenongewa vurugu patashika ay punguza kidogo na mengine kadhalika toto suna nielewa hapo hapo liposhika ukiongeza kidogo ni mwenza hota unyewa my sweetie sweetie number one my baby you your number one my darling number one roho yangu mama my sweetie sweetie number one my baby you your number one oh roho yangu mama na uivu sikatai maana uchungwa mapenzi na ujua so sije kunilagai kaja kuzama ukanizingua na uivu sikatai maana uchungwa mapenzi na ujua so sije kunilagai mwenzio na ugopa now show me how they do bololo bololo ay bololo 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 ay and show me how you do bololo bololo ay bololo bololo
And that was our Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa. Here are the English service of the Voice of America.
Now let's take a closer look at the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. In Africa, here's Woman's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. In recent memory, the votes cast by African representatives in the Security Council of the United Nations has caused much bewilderment in the corridors of the United Nations. You may recall that on 17 March 2011, when the United Nations Security Council adopted a resolution on no-fly zone in Libya, all three African members of the Council, including Nigeria and South Africa, countries that are vying to become the designated African permanent representative in the Security Council. That is, if there is a reform of the Council, which at the present circumstances does not seem likely. The major surprise then was the fact that at the time the Council was voting, a practical African Union plan was on the table. That is the 10th March roadmap, which provided a negotiation with Gaddafi and the opposition. The OAU peace plan had been swiftly denounced and rejected by the Libyan opposition on the grounds that the proposers did not rule out the removal of the then Libyan leader, Muammar Gaddafi, and also because, in their view, the African Union was not an honest broker since it was depending on the largesse of Gaddafi. However, nevertheless, all the three African members voted in favor of the resolution. But the context was also baffling. Five members of the Council, China, Brazil, Germany, India, and Russia, abstained. Without the three African votes, the resolution would not have been adopted as required by the Council, which needs 9 votes for adoption. At that time, many African commentators and experts were critical of the votes cast by the Africans in the Security Council. The passage of time has clearly demonstrated that much more attention should have been paid to the African roadmap. Had that been done, one doubts whether we would be seeing the confusion and mess that now is the case in Libya. The latest concern of the African vote came last week in the Security Council when the Arab proposal was tabled to set a time limit for the recognition of a Palestinian state along the lines of the June 1967 lines. As you may realize, there have been constant negotiations without any success. Nevertheless, one African state, Chad, who was the president of the Council, did vote for the proposal. Also interestingly, France, a permanent member, and Luxembourg, another NATO member along with France, voted for the resolution. Britain, that some have thought would vote for the resolution did not vote, but abstained. However, by abstaining, the two African states made it impossible for the resolution to be adopted since it only received 8 votes. What worried so many commentators of the United Nations, who know the UN very well, is that at a time when the African states were fighting in the United Nations for against apartheid, against white minority rule, and in favor of Namibia, the non-aligned states, having representatives from Asia, Latin America, and the Arab states, solidly backed the Africans. And on the matter of self-determination, it was inexplicable for many to understand why two African states, Nigeria and Rwanda, abstained on this crucial vote. What one can only say is this: strange things do happen in Africa. Strange things do come out of Africa. I thank you.
Thank you very much. And that was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, sports editor Shegun Ademi, and our engineer for today, Brian McCullie, we say thanks for joining us. I remember, as the elders say, if the rhythm of the drumbeat changes, the dance steps must adapt. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
North American energy ministers met last month to advance an agenda that expands the region's leadership in energy, strengthens energy security, and supports shared economic prosperity and environmental performance. Gathering in Toluca, Mexico, leaders of the United States, Mexico, and Canada affirmed that energy is a trilateral priority. They directed their energy ministers to discuss opportunities to promote common strategies supporting greater energy efficiency, infrastructure, innovation, renewable energy, unconventional energy sources, energy trade, and responsible resource development. U.S. Secretary of Energy Ernest Moniz, Secretary of Energy of Mexico Pedro Joaquin Caldwell, and Canada's Minister of Natural Resources Greg Rickford discussed options for creating a strategic vision for North America's energy sector. Key topics included public energy data and statistics collaboration, the impact of Mexico's energy reform, perspectives and opportunities for regional cooperation, and how to create a more resilient electrical grid and other energy infrastructure for North America. This is a crucial time for energy in the region. Production of conventional and unconventional oil and natural gas is surging in Canada and the United States. Mexico has recently enacted legislation that will revolutionize its energy sector, and renewable energy production and energy efficiency are taking hold in all three countries. This has resulted in an historic opportunity to reinforce North America's energy potential. Through our combined efforts, we hope to promote North American energy security, integration, and collaboration, strengthen government-to-government relationships, and support business-to-business engagement in the energy sector. Action plans will be developed in the coming weeks to implement this cooperation, and a progress report to leaders will be issued in December 2015. The United States is proud to work with its partners, Canada and Mexico, to meet the energy needs of North America and the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.